Chapter 2. You, boy, you, sit correctly. Sit in the manner prescribed. The voice was like rolling thunder. Then two heavy hands smote my ears, left, right. For a moment I thought all the temple gongs had clanged together. I saw more stars than were visible even during the clearest night. A hand grasped the collar of my robe, lifted me up to my feet, and shook me like a duster being shaken from a window. "Answer me, boy, answer me!" the angry voice shouted. But he gave me no opportunity to answer, just shaking me until my teeth rattled and my bowl fell out and rolled across the floor. My bag of barley fell and the thong became untied, loosening a shower of grain into the shocked air. Satisfied at last, the fierce man threw me aside like a rag doll. Sudden silence descended, and there was a tense air of expectancy. Cautiously, I fingered my robe at the back of my left leg. A thin trickle of blood was oozing from the ruptured scar. Silence. I looked up. An abbot was standing in the doorway, facing the fierce man. "The boy has been gravely injured," he said. "He has the inmost one's special permission to sit in the manner most comfortable. He has permission to answer a question without rising." The abbot walked over to me, looking at my blood-reddened fingers, and said, "The bleeding should soon stop. If it does not, visit the infirmary." With that, he nodded to the fierce man and left the room. "I," said the fierce man, "have come specially from Mother India to tell you the truth of Buddhism. You, in this country, have broken away from our tenets and formed your own brand called Lamaism. I have come to tell you of the original truths." He glared at me as though I were his mortal enemy. Then he told a boy to give me my bowl and my now empty barley bag. For some moments while this was being done, and while my spilled barley was being swept up, he paced around the room as though seeking another victim. He was a tall, lean man, very brown of skin, and with a great beak of a nose. He wore the robes of an old Indian order, and he looked as though he despised us. The Indian teacher walked to the end of the room and mounted the small raised platform. Carefully, he adjusted the lectern to his exact requirements. Fumbling in a leather bag which had stiff sides and square edges, he brought forth some remarkable sheets of paper. Thin paper, a hand span by two hand spans, not at all like the long, thick sheets that we were used to. They were thin, translucent, and almost as pliable as cloth. His strange leather bag fascinated me. It was highly polished, and at the center of one narrow side, it had a shiny piece of metal which clicked open when a button was touched. A piece of leather formed a highly convenient handle, and I determined that one day I would have just such a leather bag. The Indian rustled his papers, frowned severely at us, and told us the tale we had long known. I watched in profound interest the way in which the end of his nose wobbled as he spoke, and how his brow formed a sharp ridge as he squinted at the pages. The story he told us, the old familiar one. 2,500 years ago, the people of India were disillusioned with their religion. The Hindu priests were degenerate, thinking only of earthly pleasures, thinking only of personal gain. The people whom they should have been helping were turning away from their old beliefs, turning to anything that would offer a scrap of hope. Prophets and soothsayers roamed through the land with forecasts of doom and torture. Animal lovers decided that animals were better than humans, so they worshipped animals as gods. The more cultured Indians, the deep-thinking men who feared for their country, turned aside from the religion of their ancestors and pondered deeply on the sorry state of man's soul. One such man was a high Hindu Raja, an enormously rich warrior king. He worried and fretted about the future of his only son, Gautama, who had so recently been born into a troubled world. The father and family had the strongest desire that Gautama should grow up as a warrior prince and later inherit his father's kingdom. An old soothsayer called in to prophesy had said that the young man would be a prophet of great renown. To the stricken father, this was a fate worse than death. Around him, he had many examples of young upper-class men renouncing the life of comfort and going forth as pilgrims, barefooted and clad in rags, to seek a new spiritual life. The father determined to do everything possible to thwart the prophecy of the soothsayer. He laid his plans. Gautama was an artistic, sensitive young man with a keenly alert intellect which was able to sweep through subterfuge and penetrate to the heart of the matter. Autocratic both by birth and upbringing, he had yet consideration for those under him. His perceptions were such that he became aware that he was carefully guided, shielded, and permitted to meet only those who were personal servants or caste equals. At the time of the soothsayer's prophecy, the father had given the strictest orders that his son be at all times shielded from the evils and sorrows which troubled those beyond the palace confines. The boy was not to be permitted to go out alone. His travels there were to be supervised, and he should be allowed to meet no one who had poverty or suffering. Luxury, and only luxury, was to be his lot. All that money could buy was his. All that was unpleasant was ruthlessly excluded. But life cannot continue thus. Gautama was a young man of spirit, and with more than his share of determination. One day, unknown to his parents, unknown to his tutors, he slipped from the palace and with a carefully chosen servant went driving beyond the palace grounds. For the first time in his life, he saw how other castes lived. Four incidents provoked the most profound thoughts and thus changed the course of religious history. At the outset of his journey, he saw an old, old man, trembling with age and illness, leaning heavily upon two sticks as he painfully dragged himself along. Toothless, blind with cataract and senile, the old man turned a vacant face towards the young prince. For the first time in his life, Gautama realized that old age came to everyone, that with increasing weight of years, one was no longer active and supple. Badly shaken, the young prince continued his drive, full of strange and morbid thoughts. But there was another shock in store. As the horses slowed for a sharp turn, Gautama's horrified gaze chanced to alight upon a miserable figure sitting, rocking and moaning by the side of the road, a man covered with suppurating sores, emaciated and disease-ridden, was groaning as he picked yellow scabs from his body. The young Gautama was shocked to the core, sick at heart, perhaps physically sick too. He pondered the question as he was driven along, must one suffer? Does suffering come to all? Is suffering inevitable? He looked at his servant who was driving. Why was he so calm? The young prince wondered. The driver was unconcerned, as if such sights were common. This, then, must be why his father had shielded him. On they drove, with Gautama too stunned to order otherwise. Fate or destiny had not finished, though. At an exclamation from Gautama, the horses were slowed. They came to a halt. At the side of the road was a naked corpse, grotesque and bloated by the fierce heat of the sun. A flick of the driver's whip and a dense cloud of flies, feeding upon the body, rose in a swarming mass. The body, discolored and odorous, was revealed completely to the young man's sight. As he looked, a fly wandered out of the dead mouth, buzzed and settled again. For the first time in his life, Gautama saw death, knew there was death at the end of life. The young man mutely ordered the driver to return. He sat thinking of the impermanence of life, sat thinking of the beauty of a body which yet had to fall into decay. Was beauty so temporary, he wondered. The wheels revolved, the dust rose in clouds behind. The young prince sat in thought, morose and withdrawn. By chance or fate he looked up in time to see a well-clad, serene monk striding along the road. The monk, calm and tranquil, radiated an aura of inner peace, of well-being, of love for his fellow men. The brooding Gautama, shocked to the core of his being by the sights he had seen, now received another shock. Were peace, contentment, tranquility, all the virtues to be found only if one withdrew from everyday life and became a religious? A monk? A member of some mystic order? Then he resolved, would become as that monk. He would withdraw from the life of the palace, withdraw from the only life he knew. His father raged and stormed, his mother wept and pleaded. The servant was banished from the kingdom. Gautama sat alone in his room, thinking endlessly of the sights he had seen, thinking that if he had seen so much in one short excursion, his only excursion, how much more suffering and misery must there be? He refused food, pined, moped, and just sat wondering what to do, how to escape from the palace, how to become a monk. His father tried in every way he knew to lift the load of sorrow and depression afflicting the young prince. The best musicians were ordered to play constantly, that the young man should have no quiet in which to think. Jugglers, acrobats, entertainers of all types were tried. The kingdom was scoured for the most beautiful maidens, girls versed in the most exotic arts of love, that Gotama should be aroused by passion and thus lifted from his despondency. The musicians played until they dropped from exhaustion. The maidens danced and practiced erotic exercises until they too collapsed fainting from exhaustion. Then only did Gotama take notice. He stared with horror at the awkward postures of the fallen musicians. He looked with shock at the naked maidens, pale with the pallor of collapse, with the cosmetics standing out vivid and ugly now that the glow of health had vanished. Once again he pondered the impermanence of beauty, how transient it was, how quickly it fled, how sad, how ugly was life. How garish and tawdry were painted women when their immediate activity had ended. He resolved to leave, resolved to shun all that he had known, and seek tranquility wherever it might be found. His father ranted, doubled, and then troubled the palace guard. His mother screamed and became hysterical. His wife, poor woman, collapsed, and all the palace ladies wept in concert. Gotama's baby son, too young to know what was going on, yelled and shrieked in sympathy with the misery around. The palace advisers waved their hands helplessly and poured out torrents of words to no avail. For days he worked at means whereby he could leave. The palace guards knew him well. The people in the kingdom knew him not at all, for he had so rarely left the palace confines. At last, when he was almost in despair, the thought occurred to him that he had only to disguise himself from his immediate guards. From some friendly servant who was well rewarded and who immediately left the kingdom, Gotama obtained old and ragged clothes such as the mendicants wore. One night at dusk, before the palace gates were locked, he donned the old clothes and with his hair tousled and his hands and face well covered with dirt, he shuffled out with the beggars who were being turned out for the night. Into the forest he went, away from the main roads and people, fearing that his ignorance of the ways of everyday life would betray him. All the night he wandered, striving to reach the limits of his father's kingdom. He had no fear of the tigers and other wild animals prowling at night. His life had been so shielded that he did not know the danger. Back in the palace, his escape had been discovered. The whole building was searched. The outbuildings, the parks, the king rushed around shouting orders. Armed men stood at the alert. Then everyone went to bed to await the dawn when a search could be mounted. In the women's quarters there was wailing and lamentation at the fury of the king. Gotama crept through the forest, evading meetings where possible, being silent to all questions when it was not. From growing crops he took his food, living on grain, berries, and fruits, drinking from cold, clear springs. But the tale of the strange wanderer who did not behave as a wanderer should eventually reached the palace. The king's men swept forth in strength but could not catch the fugitive, as he always hid in the thickets where horses could not go. At last the king decreed that all the dancing girls should be taken to the forest, and they should go in pursuit of Gotama and attempt to lure him back. For days they dance and weave their way through the forest glades, always in sight of Gautama, always acting out their most seductive dances. At last, near the limits of his father's domain, Gautama stood forth and said that he was going into the world in search of spirituality, and he would not return. His wife rushed towards him, the baby in her arms. Gautama heeded not her pleas, but turned away and continued his journey. The Indian teacher, having got thus far in his story, which we knew as well as he, said, "From the then decadent Hindu religion, a new belief was at that moment formed, a belief that would bring comfort and hope to many. For this morning we will end our session. This afternoon we will continue. Dismiss." The others rose to their feet, bowed respectfully to the teacher, and left. I had trouble. I found that my robe had stuck to my leg scar with dried blood. The teacher left without giving me a glance. I sat in considerable pain and wondered what to do. Just then an old cleaning monk hobbled in and looked at me in surprise. "Oh," he said, "I saw the teacher leave and I came to clean. What is the trouble?" I told him, showed him how the great scar had burst open, how the blood had poured out, and how I had plugged the hole with my robe. The old man muttered, "Tsk, tsk," and hurried out as fast as he could with his own deformed legs. Soon he returned with the infirmarian. The pain was like raging fire. I felt that my flesh was being torn away from the bones. "Ah, my son," said the infirmarian, "you are as one born to trouble, as surely as sparks fly upwards." He sighed and muttered, "But why are some of these great teachers who should know better so harsh and unfeeling?" "There," he said, as he fastened an herbal compress and helped me to my shaky feet, "there, now you'll be all right. I will give you a new robe and destroy the other." "Oh, Reverend Master," I exclaimed in some fright, my knees trembling with the shock, "I cannot have a new robe, or everyone will think I'm a new boy just joined. I'd rather have this one." The old infirmarian laughed and laughed and then said, "Come on, my boy, come with me, and we'll see together what we can do about this weighty matter." Together we walked slowly down the corridor to where the infirmarian had his office. Inside, on tables, ledges, and shelves, there were containers of herbs, a few powdered minerals, and odd items which I could not then identify. Tibetans only sought medical aid in cases of extreme emergency. Not for us, the first aid kits of the West. We managed as nature intended. A broken limb would be set, of course, and a very deep wound stitched. We used the long hairs from horses' tails for stitching. When well boiled, it was very suitable. For stitching the very deepest layers, we used the long fibers from shredded bamboo. The bamboo was also used as a drainage tube when one had to drain pus from an internal wound. Clean, well-washed sphagnum moss made very useful sponge material and was also used for compresses with or without herbal ointments. The infirmarian took me into a side room which I had not noticed. From a pile of old and mended robes, he drew forth one. It was clean, well mended, and was very sun-faded. My eyes lit up at the sight, for such a robe would show that I had been in the lamasery a long, long time. The infirmarian motioned for me to take off my robe. I did so, and he examined me for other injuries. Skinny, undersized, should be bigger for your age. How old are you, boy? I told him. So, I thought you were about 3 years older. Quite a man, eh? Now try on this robe. I swelled out my chest and tried to stand straighter, to look bigger and taller, but my legs would not stretch. The robe was somewhat too big for me, and I tried to conceal the fact. Ah, said the infirmarian, you will soon grow and fill it up. Keep it on. Goodbye. But now it was time to eat. Eat before the afternoon classes. I had already lost much time, so I shuffled down to the kitchen where I explained my plight. Eat, 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 boy, and get on with it, said the friendly Soot Street cook, helping me generously. The sunlight streamed through the window. I stood with my elbows on the frame, looking out as I ate. At times the temptation was too much, and I flipped a little sampa over the edge of the bowl onto some poor, unsuspecting monk far below. More, boy? Said the cook monk in some astonishment. More? You must be hollow, or... He winked slyly at me. Are you pasting the head of the brothers? I must have blushed or looked guilty, for he laughed uproariously and said, Then let's mix a little soot with this lot. But fun could not last forever. My bowl was again empty. Below, an increasingly cross group of monks were wiping their black, spattered heads and peering suspiciously about them. One even started up the path. Hastily I withdrew from the kitchen and sauntered as nonchalantly as I could out of the kitchen and into the corridor. As I turned the corner, a glowering monk appeared and hesitated as he saw me. Let me see your bowl, he growled. Assuming my most innocent expression, I reached into my robe and produced the desired article and handed it over for inspection. Is something wrong, sir? I asked. That really is my bowl, I continued. The monk examined the bowl carefully, looking for traces of the soot which I had so thoroughly removed. He stared at me with the deepest suspicion. Then, as he handed the bowl back, said, Oh, you're the injured one. You could not have climbed the roof. Someone is dropping wet soot on us. He is on the roof, but I will catch him. With that, he turned and dashed away towards the roof. I breathed deeply and sauntered on. Behind me, there was a chuckle. And the cook monk's voice said, Well done, boy, you should be an actor. I won't give you away, or I might be the next victim. He hurried past me, off on some mysterious mission connected with food supplies, and I continued on my reluctant way back to the classroom. I was the first one there, and I stood braced in the window, looking out. It always fascinated me to look out across the country from this eminence. The sight of the beggars at the Park O'Kayling, or the Western Gate, and the never-failing thrill of seeing the eternal spume of snow blowing from the highest peaks of the Himalayas, I could spend hours days watching. Around the district of Lhasa, the mountains formed a great U. The mighty Himalayas, which formed the backbone of the continent. Having time on my hands, I looked well, making a game of it. Below me, the white, lime-washed walls of the Potala melted imperceptibly into the living rock of what had once, eons ago, been a volcano. The lime white of the man-made structure flowed into the gray and brown of the mountain, and where the one ended and the other began, no man could say now. They had fused together so successfully. The lower slopes of the mountain were covered by the small bushes through which we boys often crawled when trying to escape detection. Lower still were the buildings forming the village of Sho, with the great courts of justice, the government offices, the government printing works, the civil records offices, and the prison. It was a busy scene. Pilgrims were progressing along the pilgrim's way, hoping to acquire virtue by stretching their length on the ground, crawling forward a few feet, and then again lying prone. It certainly looked most amusing from my height above. Monks were striding about energetically between the houses. Must be the proctors after a malefactor, I thought. And lamas were proceeding about their stately business on horseback. An abbot and his retinue turned into our road and slowly rode up the wide step path towards the main entrance. A group of fortune tellers plied a brisk trade as they extolled the virtues of their horoscopes. Blessed by a Lord Abbot, mind you, sure to bring you luck. The green of the willows in the marsh across the road attracted me. The fronds were gently swaying in the breeze. Pools of water reflected the racing clouds and changed color according to the color of the passing pedestrians. One fortune teller was established on the brink of a large pool, and he was pretending to read the future of his clients in the sacred water at the foot of the Potala. Trade was brisk indeed. The Pargo Kaling was thronged. Small stalls had been erected, and itinerant traders were doing a sharp business, selling foods and sweetstuffs to the pilgrims. A profusion of amulets and charm boxes were draped over the end of one stall. The turquoise and gold ornaments flashed brightly in the sunlight. Gaily turbaned Indians, heavily bearded and with flashing eyes, strode around looking for bargains and trying to beat down the seller. Opposite towered Shakpori, Iron Mountain, slightly higher than the Potala, but not so ornate, not so many buildings. Shakpori was austere, somewhat gray and grim, but Shakpori was the home of healing, while the Potala was the home of the god. Beyond the Shakpori, the happy river sparkled and chuckled as it made its swift way down to the Bay of Bengal. By shading my eyes and straining a little, I could see the boatman paddling passengers across the river. His inflated yak-hide boat always fascinated me, and I was beginning to wonder if I would not be better as a boatman than as a small acolyte in a large lamasery. But there was no chance to be a boatman yet, as I well knew. I had to get on with my studies first, and whoever heard of a monk becoming a boatman? Far off to the left, the golden roof of the Jokang, or Cathedral of Lhasa, dazzled the eyes as it reflected the sun's rays. I watched the happy river as it wandered through the marshy land, twinkling through the willow groves, and with a small tributary flowing under the beautiful turquoise bridge. Far off, I saw a gleaming silver thread diminishing in the distance as the river followed its path towards the flat lowlands. This was a busy day. By leaning out of the window and with some danger of falling a long, long way, I could see more traders coming along the road from Drepung, coming from the high mountain passes, but it would be some considerable time before they were close enough for me to see details. Classes would start before that. The sides of the mountains were dotted with lamasseries, large ones that were self-contained towns, and small ones which clung precariously to the side of the steep rock pinnacles. Some of the very smallest ones, and the most dangerously positioned, were the hermitages of monks who had renounced the world and were walled into their small cells, there to spend the rest of their life. Was it really good, I wondered, to be so completely cut off? Did it help anyone when a young, healthy man decided to be walled up in a small cell, there to spend perhaps 40 years in total darkness, total silence, while he meditated upon life and tried to break free from the bonds of the flesh? It must be strange, I thought, to never see again, never speak again, never walk again, and to have food only every other day. End of chapter 2.